Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 6, Episode 24, Selections from the Tale of Genji, Bonus Episode. It feels like ages since we discussed Genji Monogatari, The Tale of Genji, and its prolific author Murasaki Shikibu. I gave an extremely broad overview of the story in Episode 6, the first novel, so I wanted to spend this episode enjoying selections of the work itself and basking in the luxurious romance of the Heian period nobility. I will interject periodically to introduce the passages, but mostly I just want to enjoy the prose, which is rich and satisfying even when translated into English. We will start at the beginning with the love shared between Genji Hikaru's mother and the emperor. At the court of an emperor, he lived it matters not when, there was among the many gentlewomen of the wardrobe and chamber, one who, though she was not of very high rank, was favored far beyond all the rest, so that the great ladies of the palace, each of whom had secretly hoped that she herself would be chosen, looked with scorn and hatred upon the upstart who had dispelled their dreams. Still less were her former companions, the minor ladies of the wardrobe, content to see her raised so far above them. Thus her position at court, preponderant though it was, exposed her to constant jealousy and ill will, and soon, worn out with petty vexations, she fell into a decline, growing very melancholy and retiring frequently to her home. But the emperor, so far from wearying of her now that she was no longer well or gay, grew every day more tender, and paid not the smallest heed to those who reproved him, till his conduct became the talk of all the land. And even his own barons and courtiers began to look askance at an attachment so ill-advised. They whispered among themselves that in the land beyond the sea, that is, China, such happenings had led to riot and disaster. The people of the country did indeed soon have many grievances to show, and some likened her to Yang Kui Fei, the mistress of Ming Huang. Yet, for all this discontent, so great was the sheltering power of her master's love that none dared openly molest her. Genji Hikaru's mother died tragically when he was very young, but his father, the emperor, showed him favor, and the next passage begins when he is an adult and serving as captain of the Imperial Guard. Genji the Shining One. He knew that the bearer of such a name could not escape much scrutiny and jealous censure, and that his lightest dallyings would be proclaimed to posterity. Fearing, then, lest he should appear to later ages as a mere good-for-nothing and trifler, and knowing that, so accursed is the blabbing of gossips' tongues, his most secret acts might come to light, he was obliged always to act with great prudence and to preserve at least the outward appearance of respectability. While he was still a captain of the guard and was spending most of his time at the palace, his infrequent visits to the great hall were taken as a sign that some secret passion had made its imprint on his heart. But in reality, the frivolous, commonplace, straight-ahead amours of his companions did not in the least interest him, and it was a curious trait in his character that when on rare occasions, despite all resistance, love did gain a hold of him, it was always in the most improbable and hopeless entanglement that he became involved. It was the season of the long rains. For many days there had not been a fine moment, and the court was keeping a strict fast. The people at the great hall were becoming very impatient of Genji's long residence at the palace, but the young lords, who were court pages, liked waiting upon Genji better than anyone else, always managing to put out his clothes and decorations in some marvelous new way. Among these brothers, his greatest friend was the equerry, To no Chūjō, with whom, above all other companions of his playtime, he found himself familiar and at ease. This lord, too, found the house which his father-in-law, the minister of the right, had been at pains to build for him, somewhat oppressive, while at his father's house he, like Genji, found the splendors somewhat dazzling, so that he ended by becoming Genji's constant companion at court. They shared both studies and play, and were inseparable companions on every sort of occasion, so that soon all formalities were dispensed with between them, and the inmost secrets of their hearts freely exchanged. It was on a night when the rain never ceased its dismal downpour. There were not many people about in the palace, and Genji's rooms seemed even quieter than usual. He was sitting by the lamp, looking at various books and papers. Suddenly, he began pulling some letters out of the drawers of a desk which stood nearby. This aroused To no Chūjō's curiosity. "Some of them I can show to you," said Genji, "but there are others which I had rather..." "It is just those which I want to see. Ordinary, commonplace letters are very much alike, and I do not suppose that yours differ much from mine. What I want to see are passionate letters written in moments of resentment, letters hinting consent, letters written at dusk." He begged so eagerly that Genji let him examine the drawers. It was not indeed likely that he had put any very important or secret documents in the ordinary desk. He would have hidden them away much further from sight. So he felt sure that the letters in these drawers would be nothing to worry about. After turning over a few of them, "What an astonishing variety!" To no Chūjō exclaimed, and began guessing at the writers' names, and made one or two good hits. More often he was wrong, and Genji, amused by his puzzled air, said very little but generally managed to lead him astray. At last he took the letters back, saying, "But you too must have a large collection. Show me some of yours, and my desk will be open to you with better will." "I have none that you would care to see," said To no Chūjō, and he continued, "I have at least discovered that there exists no woman of whom one can say, 'Here is perfection, this is indeed she.' There are many who have the superficial art of writing a good running hand, or, if occasion requires, of making a quick repartee. But there are few who will stand the ordeal of any further test. Usually their minds are entirely occupied by admiration for their own accomplishments, and their abuse of all rivals creates a most unpleasant impression. Some again are adored by overfond parents. These have been since childhood guarded behind lattice windows, and no knowledge of them is allowed to reach the outer world, save that of their excellence in some accomplishment or art, and this may indeed sometimes arouse our interest. She is pretty and graceful and has not yet mixed at all with the world. Such a girl, by closely copying some model and applying herself with great industry, will often succeed in really mastering one of the minor and ephemeral arts. Her friends are careful to say nothing of her defects and to exaggerate her accomplishments, and while we cannot altogether trust their praise, we cannot believe that their judgment is entirely astray. But when we take steps to test their statements, we are invariably disappointed." He paused, seeming to be slightly ashamed of the cynical tone which he had adopted, and added, "I know my experience is not large, but that is the conclusion I have come to so far." Then Genji, smiling, "And are there any who lack even one accomplishment?" "No doubt, but in such a case it is unlikely that anyone would be successfully decoyed. The number of those who have nothing to recommend them, and of those in whom nothing but good can be found, is probably equal. I divide women into three classes. Those of high rank and birth are made such a fuss of, and their weak points are so completely concealed, that we are certain to be told that they are paragons. About those of the middle class, everyone is allowed to express his own opinion, and we shall have much conflicting evidence to sift. As for the lower classes, they do not concern us." Later in the conversation, as they discuss the ideal woman, Genji himself comes close to declaring a central theme of this book and of his endless romantic adventures. No doubt the perfect woman in whom none of those essentials is lacking must somewhere exist, and it would not startle me to find her. But she would certainly be beyond the reach of a humble person like myself, and for that reason I should like to put her in a category of her own, and not to count her in our present classification. But suppose that behind some gateway overgrown with vineweed, in a place where no one knows there is a house at all, there should be locked away some creature of unimagined beauty. With what excitement should we discover her? The complete surprise of it, the upsetting of all our wise theories and classifications would be likely, I think, to lay a strange and sudden enchantment upon us. I imagine her father rather large and gruff, her brother a surly, ill-looking fellow. Locked away in an utterly blank and uninteresting bedroom, she will be subject to odd flights of fancy, so that in her hands the arts that others learn as trivial accomplishments will seem strangely full of meaning and importance. Or perhaps in some particular art she will thrill us by her delightful and unexpected mastery. Such a one may perhaps be beneath the attention of those of you who are of flawless lineage, but for my part, I find it hard to banish her. In the next passage, we can glean some of the experience of being ill in the Heian period of Japan, as Genji seeks to rid himself of an ailment while still finding time to get caught up in yet another romantic interlude. Genji fell sick of a fever. And when numerous charms and spells had been tried in vain, the illness many times returning, someone said that in a certain temple on the northern hills there lived a wise and holy man who in the summer of the year before, the fever was then rife and the usual spells were giving no relief, was able to work many signal cures. Lose no time in consulting him, for while you try one useless means after another, the disease gains greater hold upon you. At once he sent a messenger to fetch the holy man, who, however, replied that the infirmities of old age no longer permitted him to go abroad. "What is to be done?" said Genji. "I must go secretly and visit him." And taking only 4 or 5 trusted servants, he set out long before dawn. The place lay somewhat deep into the hills. It was the last day of the 3rd month, and in the capital the blossoms had all fallen. The hill cherry was not yet out, but as he approached the open country, the mists began to assume strange and lovely forms, which pleased him the more because, being one whose movements were tethered by many properties, he had seldom seen such sights before. The temples, too, delighted him. The holy man lived in a deep cave hollowed out of a high wall of rock. Genji did not send in his name and was in close disguise. But his face was well known, and the priest at once recognized him. "Forgive me," he said. "It was you, was it not, who sent for me the other day? Alas, I think no longer of the things of this world, and I am afraid I have forgotten how to work my cures. I am very sorry indeed that you have come so far." And pretending to be very much upset, he looked at Genji, laughing. But it was soon apparent that he was a man of very great piety and learning. He wrote out certain talismans and administered them, and read certain spells. By the time this was over, the sun had risen, and Genji went a little way outside the cave and looked around him. From the high ground where he was standing, he looked down on a number of scattered hermitages. A winding track led down to a hut which, though it was hedged with the same small brushwood as the rest, was more spaciously planned, having a pleasant roofed alley running out from it, and there were trim copses set around. He asked whose house it was, and was told by one of his men that a certain abbot had been living there in retirement for 2 years. "I know him well," said Genji on hearing the abbot's name. "I should not like to meet him dressed and attended as I am. I hope he will not hear." Just then, a party of nicely dressed children came out of the houses and began to pluck such flowers as are used for the decoration of altars and holy images. "There are some girls with them," said one of Genji's men. "We cannot suppose that his reverence keeps them. Who then can they be?" And to satisfy his curiosity, he went a little way down the hill and watched them. Yes, there are some very pretty girls, some of them grown up and others quite children, he came back and reported. During a great part of the morning, Genji was busy with his cure. When at last the ceremony was completed, his attendants, dreading the hour at which the fever usually returned, strove to distract his attention by taking him a little way across the mountain to a point from which the capital could be seen. "How lovely," cried Genji, "are those distances half lost in haze and that blur of shimmering woods that stretches out on every side. How could anyone be unhappy for a single instant who lived in such a place?" "This is nothing," said one of his men. "If I could but show you the lakes and mountains of other provinces, you would soon see how far they excel all that you here admire." And he began to tell him first of Mount Fuji and many another famous peak, and then of the West Country, with all its pleasant bays and shores, till he quite forgot that it was the hour of his fever. "Yonder, nearest to us," the man continued, pointing to the sea, "is the Bay of Akashi in Harima. Note it well, for though it is not a very out-of-the-way place, yet the feeling one has there of being shut off from everything save one huge waste of sea makes it the strangest and most desolate spot I know. And there it is that the daughter of a lay priest who was once governor of the province presides over a mansion of quite disproportionate and unexpected magnificence. He is the descendant of a prime minister and was expected to cut a great figure in the world, but he is a man of very singular disposition and is averse to all society. For a time he was an officer in the palace guard, but he gave this up and accepted the province of Harima. However, he soon quarreled with the local people, and announcing that he had been badly treated and was going back to the capital, he did nothing of the sort, but shaved his head and became a lay priest. Then, instead of settling, as is usually done, on some secluded hillside, he built himself a house on the seashore, which may seem to you a very strange thing to do, but as a matter of fact, whereas in that province in one place or another, and many good recluses have taken up their abode, the mountain country is far more dull and lonely, and would sorely have tried the patience of his young wife and child. And so, as to compromise, he chose the seashore. Once when I was traveling in the province of Harima, I took occasion to visit his house and noted that, though at the capital he had lived in a very modest style, here he had built on the most magnificent and lavish scale, as though determined, in spite of what had happened, now that he was free from the bother of governing the province, to spend the rest of his days in the greatest comfort imaginable. But all the while he was making great preparations for the life to come, and no ordained priest could have led a more austere and pious life. "But you spoke of his daughter," said Genji. "She is passably good-looking," he answered, "and not by any means stupid. Several governors and officers of the province have set their hearts upon her and pressed their suits most urgently, but her father has sent them all away. It seems that, though in his own person so indifferent to worldly glory, he is determined that this one child, his only object of care, should make amends for his obscurity, and has sworn that if ever she chooses against his will, and when he is gone, flouts his set purpose and injunction to satisfy some idle fancy of her own, his ghost will rise and call upon the sea to cover her." Genji listened with great attention. "Why, she is like the Vestal Virgin who may know no husband but the King Dragon of the Sea." And they laughed at the old ex-governor's absurd ambitions. The teller of the story was a son to the present governor of Harima, who, from being a clerk in the treasury, had last year been captain officer of the fifth rank. He was famous for his love adventures, and the others whispered to one another that it was with every intention of persuading the lady to disobey her father's injunctions that he had gone out of his way to visit the shore of Akashi. "I fear her breeding must be somewhat countrified," said one. "It cannot well be otherwise, seeing that she has grown up with no other company than that of her old-fashioned parents, though indeed it appears that her mother was a person of some consequence." "Why, yes," said Yoshikiyo, the governor's son. "And for this reason, she was able to secure little girls and boys from all the best houses in the capital, persuading them to pay visits to the seaside and be playmates to her own little girl, who thus acquired the most polished breeding. If an unscrupulous person were to find himself in that quarter, said another, I fear that despite the dead father's curse, he might not find it easy to resist her. The story made a deep impression upon Genji's imagination. As his gentleman well knew, whatever was fantastic or grotesque, both in people and situations, at once strongly attracted him. They were therefore not surprised to see him listen with so much attention. It is now well past noon, said one of them, and I think we may reckon that you will get safely through the day without a return of your complaint. So let us soon be starting for home. But the priest persuaded him to stay a little longer. The sinister influences are not yet wholly banished, he said. It would be well that a further ritual should continue quietly during the night. By tomorrow morning, I think you will be able to proceed. His gentlemen all urged him to stay, nor was he at all unwilling, for the novelty of such a lodging amused him. Very well, then, at dawn, he said, and having nothing to do till bedtime, which was still a long way off, he went out on the hillside, and under cover of the heavy evening, mist loitered near the brushwood hedge. The last selection I would like to share comes from the end of Genji Hikaru's story, and the chapter which follows this one was just a blank page, generally interpreted as marking his death. It is a mournful passage, and the full weight of Genji's cavalier romances come to bear upon him as his wife lays in a sickbed after a fraught and difficult childbirth. Now that Genji was somewhat less anxious about Aoi's condition, and the recollection of his extraordinary conversation with her at the crisis of her attack kept on recurring in his mind, and it made so painful an impression upon him that though it was now a long time since he had communicated with Rokujo, and he knew that she must be deeply offended, he felt that no kind of intimacy with her would ever again be possible. Yet in the end, pity prevailed, and he sent her a letter. It seemed indeed that it would at present be heartless to absent himself at all from one who had just passed through days of such terrible suffering, and from her friends who were still in a state of the greatest anxiety, and all his secret excursions were abandoned. Aoi still remained in a condition so serious that he was not allowed to see her. The child was as handsome an infant as you could wish to see. The great interest which Genji took in it, and the zest with which he entered into all the arrangements which were made for its welfare, delighted Aoi's father, inasmuch as they seemed signs of a better understanding between his daughter and Genji, and though her slow recovery caused him great anxiety, he realized that an illness such as that through which she had just passed must inevitably leave considerable traces behind it, and he persuaded himself that her condition was less dangerous than one might have supposed. The child reminded Genji of the heir apparent, and made him long to see Fujitsubo's little son again. The desire took such strong hold upon him that at last he sent Aoi a message in which he said, "It is a very long time since I have been to the palace or indeed have paid any visits at all. I am beginning to feel the need of a little distraction, so today I am going out for a short while and should like to see you before I go. I do not want to feel that we are completely cut off from one another." So he pleaded, and he was supported by her ladies, who told her that Prince Genji was her own dear lord, and that she ought not to be so proud and stiff with him. She feared that her illness had told upon her looks, and was for speaking to him with a curtain between, but this too her gentlewomen would not allow. He brought a stool close to where she was lying and began speaking to her of one thing or another. Occasionally she put in a word or two, but it was evident that she was still very weak. Nevertheless, it was difficult to believe that she had so recently seemed almost at the point of death. They were talking quietly together about those worst days of her illness and how they now seemed like an evil dream, when suddenly he recollected the extraordinary conversation he had had with her when she was lying apparently at her last gasp, and filled with a sudden bitterness, he said to her, "There are many other things that I must one day talk to you about, but you seem very tired, and perhaps I had better leave you." So saying, he arranged her pillows, brought her warm water to wash in, and in fact, played the sick nurse so well that those about her wondered where he had acquired the art. Still peerlessly beautiful, but weak and listless as she seemed as she lay motionless on the bed, at times almost to fade out of existence. He gazed at her with fond concern. Her hair, every ringlet still in its right place, was spread out over the pillow. Never before had her marvelous beauty so strangely impressed him. Was it conceivable that year after year he should have allowed such a woman to continue in estrangement from him? Still he stood gazing at her. "I must start for the palace," he said at last, "but I shall not be away long. Now that you are better, you must try to make your mother feel less anxious about you when she comes presently, for though she tries hard not to show it, she is still terribly distressed about you. You must begin now to make an effort and sit up for a little while each day. I think it is partly because she spoils you so much that you are taking so long to get well." As he left the room, robed in all the magnificence of his court attire, she followed him with her eyes more fixedly than ever before in her life. The attendance of the officers who took part in the autumn session was required, and Aoi's father accompanied Genji to the palace, as did also her brother, who needed the minister's assistance in making their arrangements for the coming political year. Many of the servants went too, and the great hall wore a deserted and melancholy aspect. Suddenly, Aoi was seized with the same choking fit as before, and was soon in a desperate condition. This news was brought to Genji in the palace, and breaking off his audience, he at once made for home. The rest followed in hot haste, and though it was appointment evening, they gave up all thought of attending the proceedings, knowing that the tragic turn of affairs at the Great Hall would be considered a sufficient excuse. It was too late to get hold of the abbot from Mount Tendai or any of the dignitaries who had given their assistance before. It was appalling that just when she seemed to have taken a turn for the better, she should so suddenly again be at the point of death, and the people at the Great Hall felt utterly helpless and bewildered. Soon the house was full of lackeys, who were arriving from every side with messages of sympathy and enquiry, but from the inhabitants of that stricken house they could obtain no information, for they seemed to do nothing but rush about from one room to another in a state of frenzy which it was terrifying to behold. Remembering that several times already her possession had reduced her to a trance-like state, they did not for some time attempt to lay out the body or even touch her pillows, but left her lying as she was. After 2 or 3 days, however, it became clear that life was extinct. Amid the general lamentations which ensued, Genji's spirits sank with the apathy of utter despair. Sorrow had followed too fast upon sorrow. Life as he saw it now was but a succession of futile miseries. The messages of condolence which poured in from all the most exalted quarters in the court and city merely fatigued and exasperated him. Here we see a sad end for the youthful adventurous Genji Hikaru and his wife Princess Aoi. So much of this book centers around how silly people are made because of love, but the characters suffer real consequences and cannot escape the suffering of life forever. I hope you have enjoyed this bonus episode, and I highly recommend acquiring the full version of The Tale of Genji if you've especially enjoyed these passages. The translation which I used is a public domain edition available at gutenberg.org, that's Gutenberg with an E-R-G, but there are plenty of newer editions available at your local library or bookstore. I will be taking another long break from this podcast in the name of my own aspirations of finishing a novel. But in the meantime, if you want more episodes, consider becoming a patron. I've reorganized our Patreon so that there is now only one tier, and for $3 a month, you can get access to exclusive episodes, including immersive, period-specific short stories which are not available anywhere else. Please consider signing up if you enjoy this podcast. I very much appreciate your support. The next season, which will cover the Kamakura period, will begin in April. And I cannot wait to tell you all about the exploits of Japan's new government, subsequent new status quo, and the complete upending of the Asian geopolitical order by a brilliant nomadic leader named Genghis Khan.